It is Monday, October the 8th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, U.S. efforts to get North Korea to give up nuclear weapons.
All the indications are they're continuing to manufacture nuclear weapons and missiles. They just haven't tested any, and they're doing all that quietly.
The latest on the missing Interpol chief, reaction to right-wing successes as well in Brazil's election.
People have just rejected the political establishment, including the Workers' Party that had ruled since 2002.
New UN findings on Myanmar's Rakhine State, plus a little something from the world of music. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. American and North Korean officials are offering positive reviews of the latest meeting between U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Neither Pompeo nor North Korea offered details, but reportedly they made progress toward a second summit between President Trump and Chairman Kim. It was Pompeo's fourth visit to North Korea, also seeking what has been described as elusive progress in efforts to persuade Kim to give up his nuclear weapons. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Robert Manning, resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, if progress was made in Pyongyang Sunday. He said yes, but it's moving at a slow pace.
You know, the North Koreans, during their final statement in their previous summit, the last summit with between the North and South with President Moon and Kim, Kim Jong-un offered to destroy a missile facility and said he would allow outside observers. And then he also offered to destroy a major nuclear facility at Yongbyon, but there was no reference to verification. But he asked the U.S., he said he would do it if the U.S. responded with corresponding measures. So I would have thought that the trip would be a discussion of what the U.S. corresponding measures might be. But it sounds like it was, so far, the results are much more vague than that. And I'm concerned because I don't see how you get from the vague promises of the Trump-Kim summit to actual denuclearization. That's going to require, you know, rolling up your sleeves and hard negotiating give and take between North Korea and U.S. senior negotiators. We got to get serious here. And the thing that's troubling to me is the first step has to be North Korea declaring its inventory of nuclear material and facilities to the International Atomic Energy Agency. Because if we don't know what they have, how can we possibly know we've denuclearized them? That should be an obvious question. I'm concerned also that the U.S. has been extremely passive, letting Kim Jong-un, since January 1st, has called all the shots, and we've reacted. And in fact, I think President Moon in South Korea has done more negotiating on our behalf with Kim Jong-un than the State Department.
As you know, President Trump has urged patience. Is that what needed here, or is there a pressing issue that has to be resolved quickly?
Well, I think that declaration of what their program is pretty pressing. I agree with President Trump and Secretary Pompeo. It's going to be a phased process. As long as we have, no more testing and so on, we have a window to operate in under which the threat is, tensions are reduced. And there's remarkable progress in cooperation and reconciliation between North and South Korea. So we have some time, but I just don't see a roadmap for how we get from where we are to actual denuclearization.
So in your written piece to the China state-run Global Times entitled "Can Pompeo Trip Turn Vague Commitment to Actions," you posit that you're concerned there could be a return to tension and war threats of 2017. Why would that take place?
Well, many of us are wondering how serious Kim Jong-un is about actual denuclearization. They've never defined what it actually is. In the past, when they used the term denuclearization, remember here, the only nuclear weapons are in North Korea. We took U.S. weapons out of South Korea in 1991. So why we're even talking about denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula rather than denuclearization of North Korea, I don't understand, number one. Everything he's doing, I think his goal has been to be accepted as a nuclear weapon state and treated like a normal country, like Pakistan. And so far, everything he's doing points in that direction. That's why I think it's imperative that we have a full inventory of what his nuclear program is, and we begin to inspect and monitor it, and that they agree to a process of trade-offs. And what will it take? on the part of the U.S. and other actors in Northeast Asia to get them to actually dismantle their nuclear weapons. And so far, it's an open question.
In the meantime, is he continuing to build up his nuclear stockpile?
All the indications are they're continuing to manufacture nuclear weapons and missiles. They just haven't tested any, and they're doing all that quietly.
Robert Manning is a resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council Scowcroft Center for Strategy and Security. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. China says it is investigating Meng Hongwei for suspected wrongdoing after the head of the global law enforcement organization Interpol and former Chinese vice minister for security was reported missing. A statement by a Chinese anti-graft body was the first official word from China about Meng since his disappearance was reported on Friday in France. Meng had been reported missing by his wife after traveling last month from France to China, where Interpol is based. Interpol being based in France. VOA asked Gordon Chang, an American columnist, blogger, television pundit, author, and lawyer, what might be going on here.
We don't know, and this is the important point. Obviously, there's some intense infighting at the top of the Communist Party, but we don't know the full extent of it. And at this particular time, I think only a small circle in Beijing really knows the story. There are many rumors, but it's going to take quite some time for us to figure out exactly what happened.
China has targeted a number of people as part of President Xi Jinping's anti-corruption drive. Could Meng be a part of all of that?
It could very well be, but the important point here is that because China has blackened its reputation in the international community, it's unlikely to be a run-of-the-mill corruption investigation, because China would not have done this, and certainly wouldn't have done it in this fashion. I suspect that Xi Jinping has making Meng a scapegoat, but that's only a guess on my part. It would seem that this has got to be extremely serious for them to have removed Meng in this particular fashion.
Meng's case has brought up under the National Advisory Commission, which handles corruption cases involving public officials. And as we've already noted, Meng might be under suspicion for violating the law. We've seen this before, haven't we?
Well, we certainly have. You know, under Xi Jinping, there has been an unprecedented purge of officials. They say it's anti-corruption, but really what's going on here is Xi Jinping is removing people that he perceives to be a political opponent, because almost all officials in China are corrupt. They're not removed for corruption. They're removed because they're on the wrong side of a political controversy. For instance, we have not seen Xi Jinping move against his family, who have accumulated wealth in an unexplained manner. We have not seen Xi Jinping move against his political allies, but we have seen Xi Jinping put anti-corruption campaigners in jail, which really means that this is not about corruption. It's really about politics. And that's the way Chinese politics are being handled these days. It is extremely serious at this particular time, as we can see from recent developments.
When Meng Hongwei joined Interpol as its chief in 2016, there were concerns raised that he would use his position there to help China target dissidents abroad under the guise of pursuing corruption. In fact, Interpol did issue a so-called red notice at one point for a Chinese billionaire. And are we seeing the tables turn now on Meng?
Well, certainly. And everyone was concerned about how the Chinese would use Interpol. But nobody, certainly not me, expected this turn of events. Because Meng was in such an advantageous position for China, we know this has got to be extremely serious for them to remove him, and to do so under the circumstances, which are just extraordinary.
Chang also said what all of this indicates is that the ruling party in China is involved in an intense dispute. Intra-party fighting is serious, and that means that China, he says, is unstable. Chang went on to say that these sorts of incidents don't happen unless there is extreme fighting at the top of the Communist Party. Gordon Chang is a contributor to The Daily Beast. He is also author of the book, The Coming Collapse of China, in which he argues that the hidden non-performing loans of the big four Chinese state banks would likely bring down China's financial system and its communist government. U.S. officials are reporting that Rohingya Muslims live in fear and mistrust and that they are not allowed to move about freely in Myanmar's Rakhine State. The U.N. Refugee Agency and the U.N. Development Program recently carried out their first assessments of conditions in northern Rakhine State since the mass exodus of Rohingya refugees to Bangladesh more than a year ago. We get the story now from Lisa Schlein at the U.N. in Geneva.
The two agencies visited 23 villages and three village tracts in Myanmar's Rakhine State. They say their teams were able to go wherever they wanted and to meet with whomever they wished. UNHCR spokesman Andre Mahechit says the focus of their meetings was to find out the conditions under which people are living and the challenges they face.
These assessments are happening in the context of the crisis that unfolded last year. So clearly there is also an impact on the way how people live. And everybody that the teams have met are facing a very difficult situation, especially in making ends meet.
Mahechit says people in Rakhine spoke about their inability to make a living and get basic services because of severe restrictions on their freedom of movement. He says mistrust, fear of neighboring communities, and a sense of insecurity are prevalent in many areas.
Fear and mistrust has an impact on access to education, health, and other basic services. It also limits interactions between communities, hindering prospects for confidence building and social cohesion. The communities we visited frequently spoke of challenges in getting to health services, as well as restrictions on the Muslim population in accessing education.
The UNHCR and UNDP signed a Memorandum of Understanding with Myanmar in early June. The MOU seeks to create conditions conducive to the voluntary, safe, dignified, and sustainable return of Rohingya refugees from Bangladesh and their reintegration in Rakhine State. On the basis of these initial assessments, Mahechit says it is clear that none of these conditions have been met. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And still ahead on VOA's International Edition, the sounds of the Manhattans.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Batty, host of your breakfast show, Daybreak Africa. As always, our newsroom is on top of the news of your interest. We provide you with up-to-the-minute news about Africa as well as world news. Tune in to our show right here on VOA Africa, your trusted source of news and information.
Well, it turns out that Brazil's presidential election on Sunday will be decided in a runoff on October 28th between conservative candidate Jair Bolsonaro and Fernando Haddad of the country's ruling Workers' Party, which is seen as leftist. Bolsonaro obtained 46.7% of the votes in Sunday's first-round voting, and Haddad got 28.37%. We asked Georgia State University Latin America scholar Jennifer McCoy, once the head of the Carter Center's Americas program, what she makes of the election outcome.
It's shocking in many ways, but not surprising in others, that given the depths of the crisis in Brazil that, you know, has arisen from huge, widespread political corruption that has alienated the voters tremendously, and an economic crisis, a slowdown in the economy, and unemployment rising, you know, that people have just rejected the political establishment, you know, including the Workers' Party that had ruled since 2002 until the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff. I think a sign of that rejection of the political establishment. Now, Bolsonaro, you know, ran as an outsider, but he's actually not. He's been in Congress for many years. So he's not a political outsider, but he's been very low-key, has not produced much, you know, has not been an effective legislator. But his candid and, you know, shocking statements, not only about law and order, but willingness, you know, to kill criminals, even extra-constitutionally, and his other kind of shocking statements about misogynist statements, racist statements, you know, led many to believe that maybe he wouldn't be elected. Now we'll see with the runoff, he's certainly got the tailwinds behind him. It's possible that if all of the opponents unite, you know, against him, that they could win. But the runoff polls look, the polls taken before this election show that it would be a tight runoff between him and the Workers' Party candidate, Haddad. But that remains to be seen in 3 weeks.
And it also appears that other politicians aligned with Bolsonaro in the down-ticket races also did well.
Yes, exactly. So that's another part of this shocking. And apparently even Dilma Rousseff lost her seat when she was expected to win. So this is clearly a massive rejection by the voters of the political class in Brazil and the need for true reform to control the corruption and the graft and to control, you know, part of it is there are various reforms that they could carry out that would require people to stay in the parties that they have been in instead of the party switching that allows for them to be tempted by bribery to move around and to support different legislation and move around parties. But right now, if Bolsonaro does take office, you know, the real fear is that he'll roll back democracy, and people seem to be willing to make that trade-off in order to get more law and order, more stability, and economic recovery.
Georgia State University Latin America scholar Jennifer McCoy. Brazil's economy has been struggling, and the Workers' Party has been held accountable as well as accused of corruption. Forbes magazine has given the current status of the Brazilian economy a thumbs-up, thumbs-down rating. In other words, progress, but not enough. Currently, unemployment within the general population stands at above 12%, according to the Brazilian Institute of Geography and Statistics. But among those aged 18 to 24, the jobless rate leaps to 26.6%. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
The chemical makeup of Earth's atmosphere is said to contain about 78% nitrogen and 21% oxygen, with argon, carbon dioxide, and other gases making up the remaining 1%. But in the atmosphere of what is considered to be the hottest, ultra-hot exoplanet found so far, scientists in Switzerland and Germany say they have found vapors of iron and titanium. The scientists say they were able to detect these heavy metals because of the incredibly hot surface temperature of the planet. Discovered last year, the exoplanet KELT-9b is said to have a dayside temperature of between 3,800 and 4,300 degrees Celsius. Scientists say the reason the exoplanet is so hot is because it orbits its host star, which is almost twice as hot as our sun, from a distance that's 30 times closer than the Earth's distance from the sun. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Now it's time for a little something from the world of music.
This has got to be the saddest day of my life. I called you here today for a bit of bad news. I won't be able to see you anymore because of my obligations and the ties that you have. We've been meeting here every day, And since this is our last day together, I want to hold you just one more time. When you turn and walk away, don't look back. I want to remember you just like this. Let's just kiss and say goodbye.
Today, there's just so many things to say.
The Manhattans are an American R&B vocal group. Their work includes million-selling songs like Kiss and Say Goodbye, recorded in 1976. They have recorded 45 hits on the Billboard R&B chart, including 12 top 10 R&B hits in the United States, charting on Billboard for the first time in 1965.
I guess what we done, oh's wrong. Please, darling, don't you cry. Let's just kiss and say goodbye. Many months have passed us by.
I'm gonna miss you.
I'm gonna miss you. I can't lie.
I'm gonna miss you.
I've got ties, and so do you. I just think this is the thing to do.
The Manhattans, originally from the U.S. state of New Jersey, formed in 1962 with members George Smitty Smith, Edward Sonny Bivens, Edward Jesse Bivens Jr., Winford Blue Lovett, Kenny Wally Kelly, and Richard Ricky Taylor. In 1983, they released the album Forever by Your Side with the song Crazy, peaking at number 4 on the R&B chart. Of the Manhattan songs reached the Billboard Hot 100, including 2 top 10s and a number 1 hit. Charting big for the group in the 1980s was Shining Star, which many fans consider their signature song.
Honey, you are my
The Manhattan's original members have all died, but Gerald Austin, who joined the group later as lead singer, is still performing with the current lineup of singers who have concert dates set for all across the U.S., Europe, and around the world. Turns out that the Manhattans are one of the top groups whose songs and their albums are downloaded. And in the top two, how about that? Moves back and forth with number one. We won't tell you who number one is. You'll be surprised. Anyway, many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you here. Latest world news is straight ahead, so we hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We all hope you have a super Monday. Now a bit more from the Manhattans.
This is Today in History. On November 7th, 1917, there was a coup against the short-lived provisional Russian government of Alexander Kerensky. Under the leadership of Vladimir Lenin, the Bolsheviks seized government buildings in Petrograd, promising land reform, an end to food shortages, and an end to the Russian involvement in the First World War. Lenin crushed all opposition in a bloody civil war that led to the creation of the Communist Soviet Union. In 1811, General William Henry Harrison, governor of Indiana Territory, defeated the Indian tribes of the Tecumseh Confederation in the Battle of Tippecanoe. Harrison would later use his fame over the victory to become president of the United States. He became the first U.S. president to die in office, serving only 32 days before dying of pneumonia. On this day in 1874, Thomas Nast, a political cartoonist for the Harper's Weekly magazine, first used the drawing of an elephant to symbolize the Republican Party. A party supporter, Nast chose the elephant for its great size, intelligence, strength, and dignity. The symbol stuck and has been used ever since. In 1967, Carl Stokes of Cleveland became the first black American to be elected mayor of a major U.S. city. Exactly 22 years later, L. Douglas Wilder of Virginia became the first elected black governor in the U.S. On this day in 1988, the American pop music group The Beach Boys celebrated their first number one hit in 22 years.
Aruba, Jamaica, ooh, I wanna take ya.
Earlier in 1988, the Beach Boys had been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.